This is Spectrum.
Alternative medicine.
Homeopathy.
Secret society.
Hypnosis.
The paranormal.
Alternative energy.
UFO.
Abduction.
The weird.
The wild.
And the wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanes and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan, here my co-host, Tom Theophanes, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Unless, of course, you're talking about loamy farmers and what they do with their evenings, and politicians and what they do in their off time, and those two subjects may not be unrelated. Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Hey, Scott, how are you?
I'm great.
Tonight's guest is Wade Frazier, who was groomed as a scientist from an early age, became fascinated by the subject of alternative energy when he was a teenager. As is so often the case with those with a clearly envisioned life mission when so young, his life path then was propelled him through a series of hard-hitting experiences that qualified him to be one of the preeminent writers on the subject today. Wade's website, ahealplanet.net, comprises of over 1,200 of deeply thought-out, intelligent, and well-informed commentary on a number of the most important issues of our time. His direct personal experiences include working shoulder-to-shoulder for a number of years with Dennis Lee, who he describes as the Indiana Jones of free energy. Wade attests that Lee's larger-than-life experiences, many of which Wade witnessed at first hand, were authentic and occurred just as he reports it on his site. Welcome, Wade.
Hi. Hi, guys.
Hey, Wade. How you doing? Nice to have you on the show. Wade Frazier, great to have you on the show. I know that you've been doing work in the free energy field for many, many years, several decades. I'm not saying you're old. I'm just saying you've been in the field for a long time.
I am gray.
Yeah. What I want to know a little bit, give us a little bit of your background, the early years, where you started out in this field. And what got you into the field?
So again, I was a science student. Again, I was raised to be a scientist, and, I went through this standard math science curriculum as a child, and was sexually expecting to be a scientist. And when I was 16 years old, I call it my mystical awakening, but our family took something called the Silva Mind Control. Today they call it the Silva Method because of the MK Ultra stuff. They decided to change the name. But I basically had what today they call a remote viewing experience, a few of those. And back then they called the Edgar Cayce Method, but I had my own. People had them I knew the people that they were describing. And anyway, so that was really kind of my a mystical awakening when I was 16 years old. And then my second year of college, somehow I decided that I didn't want to spend the rest of my life in a chemistry lab. And I really was flailing around for a direction. And a desperate prayer was answered the next morning. And I became a business student of business, strangely enough. And also when I was 16, though, I was one of my mentors. In fact, I consider my first professional mentor invented what was considered to be the best engine in the world for powering an automobile. This is back in the energy crisis days of the early 70s. And so when I was 16 years old, I had this dream of, changing the energy industry. And so but at age 16, it was just a fantasy. I couldn't do anything about it at age 16. But anyway, so I was 19. I went from being a science major to a business major, got out of college, graduated, ended up working in downtown Los Angeles for a few years. And again, when I was 20, what was I, 27, I think, I've only done it twice in my life. I prayed for guidance because I fell back into a corner. And the next morning, the answer came, and I moved to Seattle, 1,000 miles away, and moved straight into an energy company. I mean, it was again way larger than life, and so I ended up walking right into this company that was actually in its death throes, being wiped out by the energy interest in Seattle, because this guy was trying to carpet Puget Sound with these heat pumps that would save you, 80% of your heating cost. And so anyway, my childhood dreams of changing energy was, very dramatically. I mean, it's like a lightning bolt hit me, and then he couldn't get rid of me. So anyway, I chased him as the Seattle operation got wiped out. I chased him out to Boston to rebuild, and that's when he started thinking in terms of free energy. And then I ended up becoming his partner, and long story, but we ended up back in my hometown of Ventura, California, by 1987. And then my partner found that he could advertise relating to building and manufacturing and selling his heat pump, but also talking about his free energy potential, and found out that people would be mailing us checks all over the country to find out more. And all of a sudden, we went from a few volunteers to 40 people in about 2 months. And,
wow.
It was quite dramatic. I missed most of the fireworks in Seattle, but I got a taste of it in Ventura. And so we...
Now, that was Dennis Lee.
That was Dennis Lee, uh-huh. And then, anyway, then what happened was the technical wherewithal maybe to actually... This crazy idea that we had in Boston is like, it turned out that maybe we could do it. And some of the technical experts, again, inventive geniuses, et cetera, came aboard. And the next thing you know, we might have been able to do something. And so anyway, that was in 1987, 88. And then we got the boom lord on us, and so we had a raid.
Right in the middle of living the dream. You're living
the dream. In the middle of the dreams, and here comes the raid. In fact, I was standing in the parking lot as, ten vehicles, drove up in a cloud of dust, and I'm standing there in shock seeing all these vehicles drive up, and the next thing you know, the raid is on, and during the raid, they kicked us out of all of our facilities, and then they ransacked our offices and stole all of our technical material that some of our people witnessed them, because it's a long story, but we were able to see into the building and watching them ransack our facility, and then them actually telling us with a straight face afterwards that they were never in there and taking that stuff. And so, that was when we got a pretty good idea of what was coming next. Now, I was 29 years old. I was really young and naive. Now, Dennis had already been through a lot of experience at that time, and he realized that a death blow had been aimed at us and they weren't done, And so, and then we found out that exactly that they weren't done. And so he ended up getting arrested, with $1 million bail a few months later. And then it became a nightmare, And so it was quite a spectacular takedown of our operation, and wrecked my life. And it was quite right in my hometown, where this happened. And but I haven't been back to it for over 20 years. It was pretty brutal. And so Anyway, that was and then I basically had to sacrifice my life to try to spring him from jail. And my accounting professor, who kind of got me into accounting, he became my partner also. We sprung him. Miraculously, we sprung him from jail. And that's when I kind of was done playing the free energy game, And then he got out, and he went right back at it. And I pretty much said, I can't do that anymore. But he kept trying to recruit me back into the operation. And kind of a long story, but back in 1996, in fact, this has never happened before or since. He did two national kind of barnstorming tours around the United States, talking up free energy and Brown's gas, et cetera. And then the second tour was finished with putting 5,000 people into the sports stadium in Philadelphia to talk about free energy. There's never been a gathering that large that I'm aware of. And then right after that, we took Yul Brown and met with Al Gore at the White House. And anyway, it was a heady time. And then again, I came back with Dennis right at that time in New Jersey. And anyway, the whole thing collapsed, you know, a few months later. And I moved back home to Seattle. And again, 10 years later, after, you know, hearing Tom Bearden talk about it back in 98, I eventually was realizing that we were being set up by, a very elaborate sting operation that was trying to entrap us by basically, you know, being approached by organizations that had, you know, I mean, alleged, you know, almost infinite funding and how they were going to be able to give it to us. And anyway, it turns out that back in those days, that was a standard MO for contenders. In fact, again, Bearden talked about where they almost got him, and I heard him talk about it. And then 10 years later, in the wake of the financial crisis, I started thinking about the way they said they were going to get the money to us. And turns out that was the scam of the 90s. Back then, you didn't know it, but it was, anyway, it was this whole bank debenture arbitrage kind of game, which Sony was going to be dirty money. And in fact, thank God that the deals never quite materialized, and so we didn't get the money. Otherwise, I would be talking to you from prison right now. So right. Anyway, and
Dennis backed out, didn't he?
Dennis is too streetwise. So yeah, it was definitely he was very wary about groups approaching you with, you know, hey, how about $1 billion, you know? So anyway, if we had been greedy and we'd been money hungry and we really, I mean, that's the flypaper. And so we weren't, you know? And so the thing where, oh, gee, thanks very much for that kind offer. We'll think about it, you know? And again, and long story, other things happened where the deals didn't materialize. And I'll always wonder, in fact, I will be, I don't have the perspective now. I don't know who may have been, but I would imagine, based on my experiences in Seattle and Ventura, that there were probably a few agents, provocateurs on the inside that were probably being mischievous. That probably happened. So I'm just saying that the deals didn't materialize, and I'd imagine that there was some help given to why they didn't materialize, but maybe not. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Maybe they wanted a deal to materialize, and so they could put us in prison. But anyway, so didn't happen. I moved back to Seattle here in 97, and I haven't left. And Dennis is still – he's still trying. I mean, he's still – in fact, the Federal Trade Commission tried to shut him down a couple years ago now. And again, he gets – every few years, there's some big national television show, again, I don't know how to say it. I learned the media game back when I was with them back in the 80s. So let's just say that I don't bother watching the TV shows that they have about them. But I know other people watch them, and they go, oh, yeah, that wasn't very flattering. So anyway, it's just, you know, so I don't really play that game anymore. So I'm kind of, I wish them the best, and I'm sort of in a semi-retirement, if you will, in this field.
Right. You have your own website now.
I have a website.
Mm-hmm. Where you catalog all of the history of this and your information. It's called ahealedplanet.net. ahealedplanet.net. And people can go there and they can read over 1,200 pages of deeply thought out, well-informed commentary on a number of the most important issues of our time, not just free energy. You cover a lot of different areas.
Yeah, I was always a big picture guy, and I didn't know that I was being a comprehensivist. It wasn't until one of Fuller's pupils said, well, this is the stuff that Fuller did. And I'm like, really? And so then in fact, being introduced to Fuller's work really help crystallize my thinking. I mean, in fact, it was the professional grandfather I never knew I had, which was that. And in fact, some of the other, before I was been told, all I knew about Fuller was his geodesic dome, right? I think that's most people all know about his dome. But Fuller was this, he was ahead of his time. I mean, he was probably one of the West's first real comprehensive thinkers, and really awesome. And anyway, so I've encountered, over the years, I've encountered a fair number of people who were pupils. In fact, Adam Trombley was a pupil of Fuller's. And in fact, Trombley, Trombley's famous. I mean, he definitely, in fact, just before Fuller died, Trombley had his homopolar generator and demonstrated it, you know, in the UN, et cetera. And Fuller, in fact, it was like about a year before he died or something, and Fuller basically said, "Thank God I got to live to see this before I died," you know. And but he also said that Adam would probably have a rough ride doing it, and in fact he did. And in fact, I've heard that somebody's working on a documentary where maybe Adam's story will be told, kind of in a documentary setting. And I know that many of us in the field eagerly look forward to that day, you know, that his story could be told, because his story. In fact, Dennis's story is preposterous. Adam's story might even be more dramatic, you know. And Adam, he's a scientist. Again, his story, again, is also hard to believe. In fact, his father apparently was involved with the CIA in reverse engineering extraterrestrial craft, you know. And that was kind of, Adam discovered his, and Adam talks about this publicly. I mean, he found his father's diaries in his attic when he was 14 years old, you know, about, you know, reverse engineering extraterrestrial craft. In fact, his father knew, in fact, he was a colleague of Frank Snepp. And Snepp was the guy that they gave acid to, LSD to, back in the 50s without telling him they were giving him acid. And then he jumped out of a window of a hospital or something and died. I mean, very famous. This is all really famous stuff. So Adam, that was kind of his background. But anyway, when I discovered Fuller's work, after I completed my site, unfortunately, I realized that, comprehensive thinking, I get it now. And so anyway, since then, I kind of wish I would known that before I started writing my site. But anyway, it's better late than never. And so yeah. Fuller's work, yeah. I think Fuller's work, Fuller was ahead of his time. In fact, I would really love to see his work rescued from this neglect. I mean, Fuller was one of the first really comprehensive thinkers and really an amazing visionary. And so anyway.
There's been lots of people out there trudging through it, and so many of them unknowns. They're just not, they don't register out there. There's you know, the people in the pre-energy world, they know the names that you're saying. They understand mm-hmm. them. They know that the sacrifices have been made. But the general public, you know, walk down the street in New York and ask everybody, you know.
it's a cottage industry, you're right.
And it's a shame, really.
Yeah, I mean, it is. In fact, that's essentially what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to help people think comprehensively. That's what I'm trying to do, because if they do, then the energy issue, how to say it, it's at the center of the radar when you begin thinking comprehensively. And this is what, again, I was groping towards it kind of by the seat of my pants. So I was kind of the seat of the pants amateur comprehensivist. And again, later on discovering it, here's somebody like Fuller who's been down that road a long ways, you know, and really been thinking about that for many years. And so anyway, that's what I'm trying to do, is trying to help people think comprehensively so they can understand the energy issue and how it relates, and understand that free energy technology is here. I mean, it actually exists on the planet today.
Yeah, but and it has existed for a long time.
A long time, and it's kept under wraps by the people who are running the planet so they can keep us hooked, controlled. I mean, essentially hooked on scarcity and controlled. And one of the things that I attempt to do in my work is to help people see how energy scarcity defines our existences. And so many of our social structures, economic structures, even cities, if you had free energy, you probably wouldn't see too many cities. You know, it's like that's an energy scarcity concept of why you even have cities. And so anyway, it's a thing where that's what I'm trying to help people yeah. see. And it's not, you know, it's not, I don't know, it's interesting to me. I don't think it's sexy, yeah. but I think it's something that the more people who can think that way, the more chance we have to get over the hump.
Right. And getting it out there in the public. I'll tell you a true story. True story is about 13 years ago, I had one of my cars broke down. And I had been doing research in these areas of free energy and anti-gravity and all this stuff. My car broke down. It wasn't worth fixing. It cost too much money to fix it. I just got a tow truck come to pick it up, take it away. And at that point, I was so angry that cars had wheels on them still. I didn't buy a car for 12 years.
Wow.
Yeah. I was a long-standing... every time I seen a car, and I just got angry because I was like, we don't need those anymore. What are we doing? And it pissed me off, so I wouldn't buy a car. I just got one, but the only reason I got one now is because it was a gift.
So do you live in a city?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. That's,
I bust that's, everywhere.
That's, yeah, that's impressive. That's impressive, man. Not too many Westerners, particularly Americans, is gonna. In fact, you might be the first one I've met that did something like that.
That's a true story. I was so angry that cars still had wheels on them. I just was, oh, we don't even need those. We haven't needed those for 40 years or 30 years. You know, there's no way that. But the thing is that once you start getting deep, deep, deep into the rabbit hole, you realize that there are people out there playing with the toys that you don't get to play with.
Yes.
Did they do have the toys? Don't doubt they don't have the toys. They don't just suppress everything.
I know they have them. Oh no, they got some very fine toys. Very fine toys. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And yeah. So again, one of my colleagues was demonstrated. They showed off their toys once to somebody close to me, and they got a C-free energy and anti-gravity and a host of exotic technologies. Yeah.
They got the show, did they?
They got a show. Yeah, they got a show. And again, it's like I'll never get that show. You gotta be playing at some pretty high levels before you're gonna get that show. You know, and again,
in case anybody in a white hat in the white hat industry is listening, Wade would like a show, please.
No, I don't.
No.
Because they may have to kill you afterwards. It's a thing where, no, I actually don't want the show. I know people that have, and it's like, because when you play at the levels where you get a show, you also play at the levels where you're risking your life, like, really big time. And so I'm a coward. I don't want to go there, you know.
So. Okay, well, there goes my question about if they were going to offer you a show, would you take it?
No, I wouldn't.
Hell no. Okay.
Hell no. Thank you very much for the offer, but I'm not interested.
Yeah.
I will. Where I am is that the day that they say, hey, you can get a free energy machine, I will get in line to get my free energy machine. And that's me on a personal level. I will get in line with my neighborhood and wait for somebody to bring me my free energy machine. So that's kind of the level I'm playing at is I don't, you know, it's like, no, it's. That road was a little too rich for me. You know, I'm still licking my wounds from all that. And if you're at the level where you're playing, where you're getting a show, you were playing at a level where, why are you still alive? You know, and so anyway, that's the level they're playing at. And
okay,
I decided that I really don't want to throw my life away or risk it in the way that some of the people I know have risked it. So it's been there, done that.
Been there, done that. Okay. Well, we're sorry, but we got to take a quick break right now, and we'll see you guys on the other side.
If you suffer or know someone that suffers from back pain, knee pain, or any other chronic or sports-related pains, you need to visit LapingoProducts.com. Dealing with pain can affect every aspect of your life, which is why our products are designed to bring you real relief. Our products are not only easy to use, effective, and safe for the entire family, but our prices are competitive and offer a complete satisfaction guarantee. Visit LapingoProducts.com, real life solutions for pain-free living.
AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com is your gateway to over 500 products ranging from herbs to pain relief products, health, and well-being. AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com is dedicated to educating and empowering you to make the best possible informed decisions about what products you can use to improve your health and well-being. Visit AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com and bring about change in your life.
So, Wade, I want to know, in your experience and with your knowledge with all these individuals that work in the free energy, have you ever had or seen a working model of whatever out there?
So, okay. So my background is that I kind of, again, my teenage introduction to, hydraulic heat engines and, getting more energy out of a gallon of gasoline, that was my initial orientation. And then I, again, through a series of quite preposterous events, ended up meeting a guy named Dennis Lee back in 86, and he was just selling a heat pump, with these big old solar panels on it. And in fact, what happened in Seattle in 84 to 86 with Dennis, to my knowledge, it's the biggest run anybody's ever made to bring alternative energy to the American marketplace. And they brought out some pretty big guns to take them out. And in my opinion, I'm not sure the global controllers ever had to get involved. This was the local energy industry protecting its turf, not really the big guys. And so, and then after that, when I chased him out to Boston, he was basically running out of the state, and I tried to help him rebuild there. And that's when we started talking about free energy. And we were a hole-in-the-wall operation there, and we got the first, what I will say was the first friendly offer from the global controllers, and they basically offered us $10 million for the rights to our idea, which was, nothing more than, drawing on a blackboard at the time. And then a year later, when we really started getting going in California and actually had, we were pursuing so-called free energy on the thermal energy conversion part of that. And again, that's when they really, lowered the boom on us. And just before my partner was arrested with $1 million bail, he met with a CIA guy who represented European interests, and they offered him basically $1 billion to fold up the operation. And when he refused their offer, then he found himself in jail a month later. And so anyway, but that was, none of that was kind of the free energy stuff. Now, it turns out, though, that I am not, like, let's say Brian O'Leary or Tom Bearden. These guys have interacted quite a bit with inventors. I've interacted, we've interacted, a lot, but I really haven't made it a practice to keep up a lot with the state of the scientists and the inventors and developing prototypes. However, I was made aware, again, more than 20 years ago, about a guy named Sparky Sweet, who was literally down the road from us in Ventura, California, and he had a working solid state free energy prototype that he had developed, and he developed a number of them. And I've encountered three scientists, including Bearden, who, observed it, tested it, studied it. In fact, Sparky wrote a kind of a book to describe the physics behind it. And anyway, Sparky stuff was real, and I'll never forget the awe in one of our scientists' voice when he described watching it take off as ice formed on it. And anyway, so Sparky stuff was very real. And also, Sparky went and mailed working prototypes to all the big energy institutions. Now, we're talking back in the 1980s. And when he mailed off all these working prototypes, the guy literally thought he was going to get a ticker tape parade. And the opposite happened, obviously. And Sparky was basically hounded into a pretty dark end. In fact, it's pretty famous what happened to Sparky. He was given photographs of himself that were taken through the walls of his house. They were surveilling him pretty seriously, and he was threatened a number of times. And then, in fact, Sparky, being a General Electric scientist, etc., again, kind of an engineer who sort of, you know, believed in the system, we'll say. He got the FBI involved in the wire. I mean, he really approached the establishment for protection and trying to get it developed, et cetera. And a week before he died, he was actually hiding in the Mojave Desert because they had pretty much made their last ultimatum of a threat, you know. And so, again, this is more than 20 years ago. And actually, he died in, I think, 95. And in fact, I know somebody who visited him in his hiding place a few days before he died. And anyway, I've been around that stuff, you know. And so Sparky stuff was certainly real. I think, in fact, in the free energy prototype field, his is one of the ones they talk about a lot. And then, of course, Adam Trombley demonstrated his home polar device in New York City right after he talked to the United Nations. And then, as he later said, his life then became a bad spy story, you know. And I've heard privately about what that guy went through. He survived several murder attempts, you know. And so, anyway, so there's been, and again, you don't have to hear too many of those stories to get a pretty good idea of how it works when you start going public like that, when you start actually working prototypes to the energy institutions, when you start speaking at the UN and demonstrating this stuff publicly, then they got to deal with you really quickly. And so these guys really, that was a pretty rough ride. And so anyway, the thing is that actually I write about it in my work where there's a, and in fact, our experiences, there's a, in fact, Bearden, when I heard Bearden talk about it in 98, he talked about game theory and what I've seen. And again, you don't need to see that many of these circumstances to sort of get a pretty good idea what's happening on the other end of that. But they have a very sophisticated bag of tricks to derail any aspirants from ever getting very far. And their initial tactics are just surveillance, and then they have subtle ways to try to get you to fall on your sword. And if that doesn't work, then it comes a friendly buyout offer. And if that doesn't work, then the police visit you. And then if that doesn't work, then they add a couple zeros to the carrot. And if that doesn't work, then they start playing rough, you know. And there's, so there's this whole escalating series of strategies. And in fact, I've experienced, you know, most of that bag of tricks. And so it's a thing where nobody's ever gotten close. And so, and you can't, there's no, you can't sneak past them. There's nowhere to run and hide. You really have to do it in the, I mean, in fact, I remember when Dennis was in jail the first time, I was talking to a long-time, you know, observer of this scene, and he said, if you're going to play this game, you do it in downtown Manhattan. That's where you got to play that game. And you don't think you're going to go hiding somewhere in a shack in Montana. You better do it right in downtown Manhattan. Now, again, Adam Trombley did, but still, you know, he still barely survived the experience. So, again, the powers that, again, the, quote, powers that be, I mean, these guys, again, when they told Steve Greer that they paid $100 billion in quiet money, when I heard him say that back in 2004, it made perfect sense to me because I had, you know, I knew that I wasn't seeing all of them. I knew I was just seeing the tip of the iceberg, and 10,000 people at an average of $10 million each made perfect sense to me. And I'm sure the number has grown quite a bit since then. That was 20 years ago that he was told that. And I run into these stories amazingly. I run into them with people I know at work, you know. It's really pervasive, and so it's something that nobody's ever been allowed to get very close to that finish line. And
that's very interesting.
So anyway, it's quite actually, it's a carefully watched pot that they make sure will not boil. And in fact, I think that the chances of an outsider scaling those ramparts in the current environment are about zero. I see the Dennises and the Greers and the O'Learys and stuff going after it, and my hat's off to them, but the odds they are taking on are immense.
But wait, do you think guys like Greer actually have something, or they're just sort of playing sort of game?
So when you say have something, so anyway, how to say it? Like, let's say Sparky's thing. So Sparky had, I mean, he actually had real working prototypes. And again, he was, you know, he was tapping into the zero-point field. I pretty much have no doubt about that. However, the whole science about that, for a guy who's working in his garage, you know, he'd have prototypes that worked great for a while, then they just stopped working, and he couldn't figure out why. And, you know, the science, it's very delicate, you know. And there's, in fact, one of the things that becomes evident when you're starting to play around with that stuff is that it's not just a piece of equipment interacting. You know, it's not just pure physics, in that it apparently there's interactions with the consciousness of the people that are doing it. There's psychotronic effects apparently, and so there's just a lot to it. And I think that so the stuff that I'm aware of, okay, and Greer talks about 30th generation, and from what I know, I'll buy that. You know, that the stuff that's been developed in the above black world is stuff that you could put on your house. But again, you're not going to get it. I'm not going to get it, at least not now. And I personally think that the outcome of the struggle that's happening at that level in the near term is probably going to determine how this ends up going. That's what I think. And whether there are extraterrestrials involved in that mix, I wouldn't be surprised, but I am definitely not privy to what's going on there. But I'll just say that there's been enough strange stuff that I'm aware of in that field to think that at that level is probably in the near term where it's going to be decided. Now, you know, when I mortgaged my life to try to spring my partner from jail back in 1989, I thought that it was a completely futile gesture. I was just throwing my life away. And I thought the odds of it actually, you know, having a positive impact were less than 1%. You know, but it worked. I mean, we did spring him from jail. So kind of where I am is that, in fact, we've had enough divine intervention on our journey that was so strange that...
And that was, you know, Dennis Lee, was it not?
Yeah, uh-huh, yeah. And so the thing is that when you're in... And again, it's such a difficult field to play on, and though anybody who's played at those levels, it's not just the white hats and the black hats and what they're doing, but there's also something bigger happening, and you definitely you get to experience it, and you're kind of, and miracles happen and horrible things happen, but you realize that it's a heck of a lot bigger than a few guys trying to scale the ramparts, you know. And so, you know, I'm like, the people who are doing it, yeah, if we're going to be rational and stand back and say, what are the odds of actually Stephen Greer really succeeding? I would have to say about zero. But you know what? We don't see the big picture. I don't think we see everything that's going on. And so, you know, I'm always ready for the Muppet movie ending, you know, where all of a sudden, you know, somebody like Greer, he walks up to the front door and knocks, and they let him in, and they're like, oh, here, okay, fine. And in fact, my experience and the things I've heard Greer say and some of my other close associates is that Greer, and I can't say too many names here, but Greer has talked about he's been tagged this way when he was stirring things up back in the 90s, is that the global controllers, they really, they can't afford to be the people seen bringing this stuff forward. And so if you crawl over broken glass for long enough, they look at you as a contender, and you become a candidate for the person who may be able to bring it forward. And again, it's not that you're so, you know, again, anybody who brings this forward is going to realize that it wasn't them. You know, it wasn't all their virtue that brought it forward. So I'm saying those dynamics are happening. And so when a Greer keeps knocking on the door and they keep banging on the door and they keep, you know, trying things, I'm kind of going, you know what? You never know.
I had one more question that's related to this. Greer right now is been advertising for the longest time, looking for investors to put money into whatever projects that he's pursuing, uh-huh. Right? Now, if these situations are as you say, and they are such a long shot, yep. You know, why would these individuals would want to invest in something that is so dangerous and so far you know.
Okay. That's a good question. That's a good question. And I have a few possible answers. Okay. One is that, in fact, I write about it, free energy. I mean, the thing is that energy scarcity has defined the human journey. Even in our so-called advanced economies and societies, it's still energy scarcity based. And so much of the way we live is defined by energy scarcity. If you actually had free energy, in fact, it was available to everybody. And in fact, the winner would be something like what Sparky had, and it would be, you know, the size of a deck of cards, and it would power your home forever. That would just be the beginning. And you could easily see, like today, the world economies, you know, $60 to $70 trillion a year. That could easily become $50 quadrillion a year, okay, under a free energy regime. And again, it would be like Star Trek. We can barely imagine what that world would look like. However, free energy makes that world possible. And so, you know, and let me just try to put my, you know, how to say it. The word investor in that, maybe there are investors who actually think that, you know, they're going to actually strike it big. And if you did, yeah, you're not going to see the world's first trillionaire. You're going to see the world's first quadrillionaire if, you know, if somebody's going to play the Bill Gates capital game on that. However, I think it would be the end of capitalism in an under abundance-based economy. You wouldn't, again, keeping track, keeping score would really stop meaning a whole lot, you know, if everybody lived in abundance. And so the people making the so-called investments, maybe there is some of this. They want to be the firstest with the mostest. I would think, though, that a lot of them, and so there is that part of it. I mean, if you want to, again, it's sort of like, you know, when they used to sink oil wells, you know, or dig for gold, the odds of success were pretty small. But if you hit it big, you hit it big, you know. Well, this would be the biggest of the big would be hitting that one. And so, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's the biggest lottery that you could ever imagine. However, I would realistically, if I was, you know, quote, an investor, and I've been an investor in some of these things, you realistically, you'd have to look at it as a tithe. You know, I mean, to actually think you're going to get a return on it, you know, in real dollars, you got to, the odds of that happening are extremely slim. But yeah, if, you know, maybe some of these so-called investors are looking at it that way, that they might be a part of the quadrillion dollar hit. At the same time, I would think that, and in fact, Brian O'Leary's been looking for, I know, at least 10 years looking for altruists to help fund some of this stuff. Because, and again, Bearden's talked about it, to where if, I mean, like Sparky stuff. I mean, you really couldn't build Sparky stuff in a garage. And there's a big movement out there of people trying to, you know, do these things in garages, et cetera. But what I've seen, in my opinion, and again, I don't keep up on it to the extent that a Brian or a Bearden does, but they're saying, you know, a couple $100 million with an Intel-type facility, and you could get ready to mass-produce like a Sparky Suite, you know, solid-state free energy device. And at the same, but that's what it takes. The problem is that once you start getting the money to do something like that, I mean, you're going to definitely be on the radar. And so, to me, it's not so much a question of, gee, can you get some money together to build a facility like that, et cetera. It's will you be allowed to do something like that? Yeah. And again, the bag of tricks, let's put it this way.
I guess the question would be,
people around the world, they want to take you out, you don't have a prayer. I mean, that's right. Where I am. You don't have a prayer if they want to take you out.
Yeah, I guess the question would be to investors would be, how much is this bullseye in the back of my head going to cost me?
Oh, yeah, it's, again, if you're playing that game, and again, do it in downtown Manhattan, and yes, you have a tremendous bullseye on you. And however, and this is what I'm going to say, is that the so-called black hats, yeah, they'll be watching very carefully, but so do the white hats. And this I know for a fact. Okay, and so both sides are watching very carefully, and both sides act very subtly. Sometimes they act very dramatically, but it's quite subtle too. And so I'm saying, if you go onto that arena and you're playing, the forces that are involved and watching and encouraging or discouraging you, from my experience, you have barely any idea of what's really going on. And also, the things that I've experienced is that some of what's going on, the attention that is being got on this, it's not just worldly physical reality either. Okay, and so again, I've had some divine intervention, voice in my head. I've had things happen to where you realize that there's something a lot bigger happening. And so anyway, to me, it's big stuff. I mean, I the energy issue and the free energy technology, et cetera, I don't know of a bigger issue on the planet right now. And so that's the one, again, the human journey. If everybody on the planet could have access to 1,000 times their daily calories. I mean, today the average American only has access to 80 times their daily calories, and that's only Americans. I mean, the world average is, 15 or something. And if everybody had access to 1,000 times their daily calories and there was no environmental impact to that, again, I've been living with that for a long time. I can barely imagine what that looks like, And so, anyway, it's big stuff, and it's pretty overwhelming stuff. And that's part of one of the actually perils of all of this is that the implications are so tremendous and overwhelming that, it's daunting to even think about it. And so, anyway, that's part of the territory.
Okay. Now, I've heard, and this is just what I've heard through the grapevine, that you can play around with a whole bunch of different subjects in the alternative field. You can play around with ghosts. You can play around with parapsychology. You can play around with remote viewing. Mm-hmm. UFOs, you can play there as much as you want, pretty much. There's some barriers. There's some things you got to watch out for. Yep. But generally, if you start playing in the free energy field, then you better suit up.
Well, that energy is the linchpin for the world economy and always has been, okay? So that's real. And that's got an economic impact. And the people who run the planet, their leverage is economically. I mean, we're living in an era of artificially enforced scarcity, okay? And so they know that enforcing the energy scarcity paradigm is what keeps them in power. And so, yes, if you start playing around with, starting to change the energy paradigm, that's what I'm saying. That's the most carefully watched pot that I know of. And in fact, of the $100 billion in quiet money that, 20 years ago they told Greer they paid out, I'm guessing, but I'm going to say that I'm sure that at least $80 billion of it was around disruptive energy technologies. And it, everywhere from 100 mile per gallon carburetor to super heat pumps to, again, something like what Sparky had. Yes, and it's economics. So it's economics is what it's all about.
Okay, but I did want to ask you, Tom, now you've been in the UFO field long enough to know that we hear stories about people being followed and being bothered and all kinds of stuff like that in the UFO field. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll say I don't believe about 80% of it.
That's wise.
Well, it's just the UFO field's a great field to be in, but there's all kinds of room for imagination.
You may be underestimating the percentage.
But Tom, with you being so many years for being the director of MUFON, you've run into situations where you hear this, you hear that people are being followed and there's all kinds of stuff going on.
You hear it all the time. And I mean, in the UFO field is just full of that. And unfortunately, I've never come across anything that had any merit to warrant such a thing. The thing is that, no matter what in the UFO field right now, whether you were, whether you saw something unusual, whether you had an abduction, whether you, were visited by men in black or whatever the story might be, very seldom that has any impact on general life, for that matter. And whether anybody is going to believe your story, it's even worse. So really, why would they be chasing you and trying to quiet you down for something that, A, nobody's going to believe you anyways.
Right.
No?
That's specifically the UFO field. Now, yeah. Tom, we will put a caveat here that saying that this is not always the case. I've seen some really weird things in the UFO field. You've had some really, really unusual cases that you just can't answer. You, the thing is, though, at the end of the day, Tom can just go, I don't know, weird stuff happened. I can't explain that stuff. But he's not holding an alien in his closet and saying, you know, opening the door and going, look, taking pictures. Yes. But it's no doubt we've run into weird things that we couldn't explain. No doubt about it.
Well, I mean, this whole world is full of weird stuff, you know. And
I agree.
And, you know, no matter what, you know, denial that you may have from skeptics and you know, scientists and whatever name you want to use for them, there's plenty of you know, unusual circumstances that occur almost every day out there that we can't really explain. Because we have very little knowledge of our world that we live around us. Right? So, but nonetheless, this particular field of the free energy, I found it, you know, particularly interesting over the years because, you know, even though I'm not into it in the sense that, you know, the way you've worked over the years, but, you know, I keep an eye on things, on, you know, the things that come out or people claims and so on and so forth. I remember back in the late 70s, there was a couple of guys that had came with an invention that you would put between your carburetor and your gas filter area there, and it would create like an ionized where the gasoline was passing. It would ionize the gasoline, so in other words, it would burn cleaner, right?
Yep.
And it wouldn't like, you know, because nowadays the cars are better, but back in those days, you know, half of the gasoline will probably you shooting it out your pipe, right?
Yes.
So this was, you know, creating a situation where you're burning the gas better, more efficient. The water was being circulated instead of, you know, evaporating and such. And you were able to get, you know, 2-3 times the gas mileage that, you know, you were getting. Now, they sold those devices for, I don't know, about a year, I guess. Then I heard that somebody bought them out, and matter of fact, they were in Hamilton, where Scott is from. You know, then they sort of disappeared from the marketplace. But towards the end, I was hearing that they were developing, you know, something a little bit more slicker, something that could do a little bit better job. Now, you got to remember, back in the late 70s, gasoline was like, what, maybe 10 cents a gallon?
Yeah, I hear you.
Or thereabouts.
Before 74, anyway, I hear you. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and now, you know, of course, if there's plenty of these things that have, you know, popped in and out over the years, you know, they'll pop in for maybe a couple of months, you see them selling somewhere, and then they disappear, you know?
Absolutely.
And one of the things that, you know, I had heard, well, recently, I would say, you know, within the last year, and I heard it on the news numerous times in that time, was that in Japan, they want to convert numerous gas stations into putting air instead, you know, for these new engines that they had developed that run on compressed air.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, if you run an engine on compressed air, you know, how come now all these big boys didn't create a big fuss down there as yet?
What I'm saying is that, and this is a thing that I see a lot of, is that people talk about, you know, hydrogen or compressed air or, I mean, batteries or all these things, but it's none of that is novel in the sense of you're getting more energy than you otherwise could, because ultimately you're burning a fossil fuel to get it. Okay, in the United States, the electricity to compress that air is coming from burning coal. You know, and so heck, the Rockefellers, John Rockefeller, he owned coal companies back then. So John Rockefeller would be, you know, let's say 100 years ago they'd have done this, Rockefeller would have said, "Well, fine, they're going to either get my petroleum or they're going to buy my coal." As far as the guys who run the world are concerned, compressed air cars and people doing biofuels and windmills and stuff, they yawn. You know, yeah, it's like none of that's a threat. No. None of that's a threat to them.
Not even vaguely a threat.
It's not even on the radar. You know,
they
there's
giggle
like
and slap knees at that point.
Yeah, in fact, that's the thing where, about a year ago, and you don't see this very often, but about a year ago, I ran into Bill Gates at the movie theater here about a year ago to watch Avatar, and, you know, he just nobody recognized him. He's in the popcorn line ahead of me, and nobody recognized the guy. About a week later, he wrote an article. In fact, he started actually still sort of campaigning on this, pretty much, you know, one of the few sane voices out there, at least describing the problem, and he's saying, hey, all this biofuels and windmills and all that stuff. He goes, none of that's going to save us. You know, we got to come up with something radically different we got to find a radical new way of getting energy. And when I heard that, I'm going, wow, that's pretty astute. Now on the public scene, you pretty much don't see that. At the same time, I think, and I don't follow it that much, but Gates then, you know, his suggestions of how to do that was kind of the usual suspects of some of that stuff. So it really wasn't, in the end, it wasn't really very radical. However, you know, the perception that, you know, all these so-called solutions that are being bandied about aren't, that was perceptive of him. And so I gave him a point for that. But yeah.
Well, if you want eventually to get the rest of the muggles out there on the planet, because this stuff has to eventually come out, you would want to, you know, you want to sort of lead the conversation. You don't want anybody who's a rogue leading the conversation and putting the information out there. Therefore, you use someone like, you know, a complete patsy like Bill Gates.
I hear what you're saying. It's possible. And however, though, and this is...
If you don't think he's part of the club...
Well, you know what? He's not. the guys who really run the world, you never heard of them.
That's true. I would agree with that.
I mean, Bill Gates, he's just a boy with his toys as far as they're concerned. As long as he's playing vaccinations and this kind of stuff, they know the game. They know that he's not a threat, okay? But anyway, what I was going to say about that, though, is that, how to say it, the free energy genie, they know. The people who run the world, because again, like Sparky Sweet stuff, if that genie ever got out of the bottle, they're never going to be able to put it back in. And so I said that is the most carefully watched bottle that is on the planet, and it's been that way for a long time. And in fact, they don't have to micromanage this thing, okay? So yeah, they can. So when you tap into the zero point field, they can detect it, you know, so they can detect when you're on the zero point field. And in fact, I get this pretty regularly, people wondering how they can shield it from detection and stuff. And it's like, you can't run under their radar. Don't even, you know, when people think they can, you can't, you know, you can't run under the radar. And so don't even think about it. And in fact, trying to play the secrecy game, we're going to sneak up on them. I mean, You already defeated yourself when you actually start trying to play that game. And right. The thing is that you can't sneak past them. And but they do know that if they ever let this stuff out, they would not be able to control it for very long. And,
right.
And they know. And so that's why it's such a, again, of that $100 billion in quiet money, I've never heard of those kind of numbers being thrown around for anything else on the planet for keeping the lid on stuff. I mean, in alternative medicine, they just wipe you out. You know, I mean, again, only in the energy field will they actually dangle big carrots, you know, before they get out the big sticks, you know, and it's because that they know that it is the ball game. If they let that genie out of the bottle, it's game over for their world domination paradigm. I mean, they won't be able to play any longer. And so, anyway, it's economics. I mean, that's at the level they play at, the game is power. Okay. However, the way that they maintain their power is economically. And as long as they have the hand over the lever of the global economy, which is rooted in energy, then, you know, they control things. And so that's the game that's being played. And again, I've been there. I played at the level. In fact, you brought up an interesting question earlier about, you know, the UFO people and surveillance, et cetera. I will say that it is only when you start playing, again, at that very high level, and you're out there in the middle of Manhattan, you know, demonstrating a free energy device, then the attention becomes visible, and you get to see, and you don't get to see everything, but you see enough to where you realize that, there's something that's very interested in what's happening here, and they're going to prevent me from doing a whole lot, or they're going to assist me in doing something. And the people that I know that have played this, again, very few play it, and in fact, very few play it and survive for long doing it, but it's only when you start playing at those levels does the surveillance apparatus become visible, and the helping hand or the hindering hand becomes quite visible, you know. And so, again, when the CIA guy sat down with Dennis and offered him, you know, in fact, I never even heard about the offer until several years after it was made for a number of reasons I can't go into right now. But, I mean, they basically told, and again, I've heard Greer say this several years later. They said, hey, here's the deal. We'll put a one on the check. You put the zeros on the check, you know. And, in fact, Dennis made a counteroffer, and he said, you know, that sounds like an interesting offer. You put the one on, I'll put the zeros on. And it goes back into your pocket, and that's earmarked for bringing free energy up to the world. And the CIA guy, I think, choked on his soup at that moment, and he said he couldn't accept that counteroffer, but he'd have to go back to his superiors and talk it over. Well, that was the last time they made that offer. And then
I think the officer, the CIA guy, knew the answer before he said he had to go back and talk to anybody.
Exactly. In fact, the CIA guy swung by. In fact, Dennis met him in Chicago, and the guy came out to Ventura a couple weeks later just to kind of say hi. And so they had dinner, and the guy never brought up the offer. And in fact, again, a couple weeks later, Dennis is in jail with $1 million bail, and Dennis has written that he thinks that was their answer, was the jail with $1 million bail. And
counter offer.
That was their final offer, let's say. And but anyway, so
our final offer is you go to jail.
Yes, exactly. And we can make it up as we go. And that was kind of my awakening, is I saw Kangaroo Court in action. They can make it up as they go. I mean, they can just make it up as they go.
Can I ask you what specific charges did they put on this individual?
You didn't file a form. Yeah, there was some obscure franchise law in California where you were supposed to file a one-page form to the Secretary of State and pay $50. That was the crime.
And that carries a sentence?
Well, of the other 100,000 people who have committed that crime, nobody's ever been arrested on that. But my partner spent 2 years behind bars on that. Yes. So, and in fact, they were going for life imprisonment, and a few of us sacrificed our lives, and we put that in quotes, one, where he only spent 2 years behind bars, and almost got killed in there. But anyway, that was a rough ride, and it's a thing where they can just make it up as they go. And so, in fact, Dennis
and Tom, back in Tom, the days, you've seen enough of Kangaroo Court to know they could do that.
Yes, I have.
Yeah. In fact, Dennis, the law they got him on, he said it was kind of one of these red tie on a Tuesday laws, to where they outlawed wearing a red tie on a Tuesday, and you're in a sea of people wearing a red tie on a Tuesday, but you're the one they put in prison for it, you know. And so, and that's essentially what happened. And it was pretty high profile. Pretty brutal stuff, you know. And in fact, to this day, and you'll never hear him admit it, but that was a pretty legendary, because we didn't give up. We didn't just roll over and play dead. It was a pretty high-profile, bloody battle that Ventura County has never forgotten. And back since then, you know. But it was nasty.
Was there a lot of media involvement in that?
Oh God, you know, you're on the evening news, and oh yeah, it was big. It was big. In fact,
how were they managing to do such a thing when the media got involved?
What do you mean?
Like, I mean, if it was a trumped up charge of something Mickey Mouse like that, how did they manage to push through it without the media and, you know, the people?
Oh no, media's part of it. Media's part of the whole thing. So no, this is how it works. Okay, so it's like, in fact, here in Seattle, the same thing happened. So what they do is you're con man of the century, and you're all this. And again, it's sort of like, how to say it, it's what do they call it? You're convicted in the court of public opinion. Anyway, they create all these sensational statements and all this, you know, I mean, all this. I mean, you know, you killed your mother and all this kind of stuff, and the media reports it and everything else. But when you actually get to the charges, it's, oh, you didn't file the form. But that's not the part that, you know, that doesn't, the media doesn't tell that part of the story, you know. So anyway, I got to see how it works, you know. And so the media is a propagandist. I mean, the media is a part of the system, like, completely, you know.
Oh, no, so, no doubt, no doubt.
In fact, the local paper, the reporter, I mean, he was a stenographer. I mean, the sheriff's department was basically telling him what to write, you know, and he dutifully just, you know, parroted everything they told him to write. I mean, they would take videotapes and mail them to the LA TV stations. The next thing you know, I'm getting phone calls on, you know, or on the news. And, oh, I mean, every few years, I mean, today, I mean, they 2 years ago, I think Dateline did a show on Dennis. I mean, he's had several national TV shows on him, and they all lie. I mean, they lie. They just make it up as they go. There's this quote skeptic guy who's made a career out of being on these national TV shows, and I mean, they just lie. They can make it up as they go. And so that's the thing. Facts don't matter. I mean, they can just say whatever they want to. And the thing is that they, you know, how to say it? It's the thing where, you know, you have the facts, you have the truth, but they have the lies, but they have the access. You know, they actually are the ones who are broadcasting to everybody. And so, again, it was a very educational process to see how the propaganda system and the control system operates, you know. And so, yeah, it's like you didn't file a form. And then you're splashed all, I mean, to this day, all the TV shows and stuff, it's all this axe murder stuff. And what was the charge? What was he convicted on? Not filing the form. But that part doesn't make it into the story, you know. So anyway,
the story has got to be newsworthy, and not filling out the form is not newsworthy.
Of course not, you know. And so it was my radicalizing experience to actually be on the receiving end of that stuff. You know, in fact, I'll never forget, you know, this whole page LA Times article that was the Ventura County edition of the LA Times. And it was the full blown out, you know, I don't know how many thousand words it was, and I'm sitting there reading, and it's just, again, they can just make it up as they go, you know. And it's like, and there's the quote news, you know, and you're reading it, if you've never had this happen to you, you're actually reading about yourself, but you're like, who are they writing about? You know, and it's like, it's nobody I know, but it's supposedly you, you know, and it's pretty incredible to be on the receiving end of that. So that was, again, that was back
in the 80s. If you've never been targeted, you don't know.
You have no idea. That's right. If you've never been targeted, you got no idea, you know, and unfortunately, most people have never been targeted, so they have no idea what you're talking about. And even when you know, let them, in fact, one of my frustrations over the years is people who think they're going to go scale the free energy ramparts, and they have nobody's ever gotten within, you know, 1,000 miles of the dragon, you know, before they get charred, you know, and they think they're going to go and sneak up on them or scale the ramparts, and they've never even, their armor doesn't even have a scratch on it yet, you know. And I just, you know, and you know what, they don't want to hear it. You know, it's kind of like trying to tell an 18-year-old, you know, boy, what a battlefield's like, you know. Yeah. It's like, they don't know.
You're trying to tell them, look, do you see that field over there you're about to walk through? It's full of mines.
Exactly.
And they just go, no effect on me, you know.
Oh,
I wonder if Jake Morgan.
Yes, and I've, over the years, I keep seeing the aspirants all, like, thinking they're going to just, you know, dance across that minefield, and I pretty much said, you know, I hope you don't mind, but I don't want to look, you know. And so I really don't keep up on that stuff much anymore, just because, I mean, other people have done this. Other people have cataloged all the casualties of the minefield. And I pretty much, I'm doing something different, you know. And again, I've been there, done that. I've seen the, you know, I've had to cart the corpses off and stuff. And I've done that. But it's a thing where, and I pretty much said, I don't think that's a productive game to play, you know, and in fact, and again, the people who actually do have some idea what they're getting into and they're doing that, I got nothing but respect for them. You know, it's like, wow. And I know what they're, and if they have any idea what they're getting into, they have a hell of a lot more courage than I do, you know, and there are some people doing that. I mean, there are, Dennis is still trying. I mean, it's like, in fact, both times when he got out of incarceration, I mean, both times he's behind bars for a year, right?
Right.
And I meet him like immediately after coming out both times, and his first response was, well, that didn't hurt much, and it was educational. I'm going right back at it harder now, and I'm just my jaw's hanging on the floor, you know. And it's like, wow. So there's people like that, but there aren't many, you know.
Right.
And for people that are doing that, I've got nothing but respect for them, you know. And at the same time, it's just. That's hard, man. That's some hard stuff to watch lives get destroyed. I've seen a lot of lives wrecked. I've seen lives prematurely ended. That's not fun, you know. And so I pretty much decided that I can't do that anymore, you know, because it's, you know, Indiana Jones can do that, but, you know, he wears out a few sidekicks, you know.
I guess it's similar to the people working in the anti-gravity field, or inverse gravity, whatever you want to call it, and coming up with those sort of devices. We had a physicist on the show, Stoyan Sarg, who's basically done lab work. And he's not he knows about theory, but he's more of a lab guy, a lab physicist.
Uh-huh.
And he wants to do it in the lab, working with the plasma and have an effect and, you know, do the numbers and make sure that, film the effect and make sure it's happening. He's done it. Tom's witnessed it. He's seen the experiment.
Yep.
And these sorts of people, you know, they're out there and they're doing the work. But he needs like $200,000 to get the amount of power that he needs to do the next level of the experiment. And it just doesn't show up.
Well, and again, he is being watched. I mean, he's being surveilled. And I mean, I tell you, they literally have kind of their manual, their playbook, right? And this guy is, and let's just say that, I mean, I'm not kidding. It's like they're looking, they got him on their little radar, and he's at level 2.
Right.
And they're like, okay, well, and we can let him get to level 3. And if he gets to level 4, then we're going to have to maybe do something.
Right.
I mean, that's literally the way it works, you know. And so, anyway, and that's, you just got to, you play those games, you are on the radar, and if you get very far along, you will start to see. And again, I'll tell you, the people I know that have, even in my own situation, it is such a science that they have, is that if you've been suppressed and messed with, most of the time, you don't even realize what they did. Okay? It's not until 10 years later that you realize that, oh, that, you know, I had that heart attack, you know, that almost killed me, and now I'm realizing that it was induced, you know? Or, this is it's a very subtle game they play. And in fact, the thing is that the reason it's so subtle is that so it can't all be, you know, how to say it, it can't be obvious. It's a very subtle game they play. So
well, there's also, the legal way.
Pardon?
They can take you. There's 100 different ways they can take you out legally.
Yes, they I'll tell you, getting violent, that's like way, they don't do it till you're up to a level 7 or 8, okay, before they have to get violent, okay? That's kind of, you're getting close enough to the end game, the end zone, where now they have to really start getting active, okay? And in fact, there was Eugene Malov. In fact, we had this energy conference in 2004. And in fact, he was the first speaker. In fact, most of the energy movement more knew him. And the week after we lined him up to be our first speaker, he was murdered, you know? And even today, it's still an unsolved crime. And Bearden and Greer, both pretty much, they've said it publicly. I mean, it's like, he was made an example of, you know, and it's like, and there was enough strange stuff happening during that time that I'm, yeah, I will, I don't think I'll ever buy the random crime angle of his death, you know, and so, but however, today is still an unsolved murder, you know, and so, and I again, it's, I think that those are unusual anymore.
I think we have enough cases in history. We have enough cases in history of suppression and different levels and degrees of suppression that we can say that it does exist. I mean, going back to Tesla and J.P. Morgan and their exchange, yep. Tesla was like innocent in a way, whereas when it comes to the business mind, and a brilliant man, absolutely brilliant, but when he thought that that J.P. Morgan was going to give away energy for free, he thought that this was going to be received with a hug and a handshake.
Well, yeah, and that's, again, Sparky Sweet mailing off these working prototypes of his device, thinking he was going to get a ticker tape parade. And, in fact, that is the how to say it? When the guys who run the world, the guys who are watching this, as soon as they see some inventor applying for a patent, they know that, I mean, that's kind of like the standard play. They go back to, okay, I mean, they stick some flunky on that one because he's already done. He's already done. I mean, the fact that anybody who's trying to get inventor rights and all this kind of stuff, it's over. I mean, there's just no, I mean, that's just, how to say it, that's one of the first lion dens they walk into is going to the patent office thinking they're going to get, you know, patent protection and be able to, I mean, sorry, that's never going to work.
Yeah,
you know?
And so, a week later they're going to be on Oprah. And, yeah.
All that stuff, absolutely. You know, that's, and in fact, I'll tell you, for myself, and I don't know about you, I mean, because of my background and what I'm constantly getting essentially bombarded with the latest aspirant, you know, and that's not my bag anymore, you know, but it's like, I pretty much, you know, don't want to watch. I'm trying to do something else. And I said, I you know, but when I hear, I see these news shows of some guy in his garage and he's got some buddy who thinks he can raise some money. And yeah, I don't even know what to say. You know, it's just like lamb to the slaughter. That's all I often said to that, you know, and said, if they're really lucky, they'll get the buyout. You know, and they'll actually get their $5 million or whatever. And in fact, of the 10,000 people that got paid off, and again, Greer could correct me on this. I don't know if they even told him, but I would imagine that most of the time, because I remember we got the $10 million buyout offer in Boston, a very nondescript, some really nondescript businessmen, you know, and they're just like, hey, how about, and he gets the friendly buyout offer. I would say that most of the time, the people who took the money, they had no idea. Yeah. What was really going on. They wanted the money anyway. So they're like, oh, that's cool. $10 million for that? Well, thank you. I think I'll get a nice tan in the Bahamas now. And they never had any idea what might have happened if they had been a little, resistant to the plan. And in fact, I have seen enough of these situations where, in fact, one of my coworkers was a Justice Department investigator who, you know, we're talking going back, you know, 30, 40 years where 100 mile per gallon carburetor deal, you know, and the guy wouldn't take the money and right. Eventually got the Justice Department involved. Well, again, their pockets are so deep to keep this stuff under wraps, they just add a couple zeros to the offer. So instead of the $500,000 in a sack of cash, when he got the Justice Department involved, it became $50 million, you know? And so, but again, they just, you know, they can.
And then nobody ever heard from him again.
Well, that's exactly, you know, and in fact, this one guy, again, it was educational to hear these stories, you know, again, to the investigator for the Justice Department who actually, you know, who looked into it, and he was the one who was, in fact, this guy, after he got the death threat from the automobile company, he actually got the Justice Department involved, and essentially the Justice Department said, so what do you want us to do about it? And the guy's like, well, protect me, you know, and the response as delivered by my coworker, and again, this is many years after he was no longer working in the Justice Department, was essentially, you know, yes, we can change your identity and move you somewhere in the country, and they're never going to find you, except it looks like you're really interested in trying to get this stuff out there. So, you know, as soon as you start trying again, well, you're back on the radar. So we suggest you settle. And so anyway, the deal got 100 times better, you know. And so again, it's easy.
And he went away. Hey, Tom. Mm-hmm. Maybe Stoyan's shooting a little low. He only needs $100,000 to up his. Tom's seen the experiment. This guy's done the. Because some of the critics said when he did his first experiment, they said, "Oh, that's ion win." Uh-huh. But he got there. That movement. He moves objects with. He does a pulse technique with mm-hmm. energy, and magnets as well. Everything. And he said, "Okay, fine, no problem." He did it in a vacuum tube. With the same movement and effect, mm-hmm. right? And filmed it, but to go to the next level, he needs a certain amount of energy. The lab that he worked in didn't have the energy capacity that he needed to take it to the.
That's like Tesla, wiping out Colorado Springs for a day, right?
Yeah, exactly. So to go to the next level, he needs a different lab, and now the different lab is in a different university. And there's money, going to be money involved. It's going to cost money. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he's already working in a university. So to go and do that is going to take, now they want money for it. And it's like, mm-hmm. okay, well, I can't really do that unless I have $100,000. Unless he uh-huh. wants to do it out of his own pocket. And, sure. It may be a great job working in a university, but I don't think they pay you that well.
No.
That you can just fund your own research.
Absolutely. And again, what you're describing, I mean, that's a standard story, and it's like usually the inventor who's doing this kind of stuff, his credit cards are maxed out. He's mortgaged his house. He's on the last thing. He's trying to get that next nut, and it's just, and again, you're not even within 1,000 miles of the Dragon's Lair when you're there. All I'm saying is that most of the time people doing that, it never rises to the level where the big guys need to do anything. I mean, you're usually going to fall on your own sword, or you're not going to have enough money. It's always shoestring. In fact, Brian O'Leary, when he was getting involved in this 20 years ago, and this was again, I think an important thing to understand. He was involved. There was some big high-tech multi-bazillionaire guy who funded a conference in Colorado. I think, they were filming a Dumb and Dumber with Jim Carrey at the same time, and they were there. Anyway, so there's this guy, this big rich guy who's, Bearden's there, and basically the names of Free Energy are there, and Brian's there, and there's this, and the marketing people for the bazillionaire basically gave a presentation to, all these free energy people and basically said that, this early stage development stuff, it's just the rate of return is not going to be, it's not there, And so we're really not going to devote much funding to this unless, I'm going to become the next Bill Gates of energy. So, and in fact, Brian eventually, Brian says this a lot in his work ever since then, there's this kind of no man's land, between the guy in his garage and capitalist, the capitalist world picking it up and taking it and trying to develop it for market. And there's this huge gulf that's the venture capitalist world, et cetera. And the thing is that if an inventor works with the venture capitalists, he's going to lose the rights to it. Okay, and again, that's another.
Yeah,
again,
sure, we'll give you the money, no problem. We'll let you develop your dream. But we need to get a return.
A return. And when it gets into that world of economics and all this money, et cetera, again, the guys who run the world, when they see that, again, it's just like, oh, that's. They're at 2.5 now, And again, it's not even to the nuisance level yet. And the fact is they know that capitalism is such a shark tank anyway, that usually the treasure of the Sierra Madre effect takes over and then it ends up in a bloodbath anyway because everybody's fighting over it because they some primeval level of them realizes this is a quadrillion-dollar technology. And so it's just, and I've seen this, oh, it's bloody, and it's kind of like, and maybe a couple people survive that experience, and the technology ends up, I can't tell you how many, people's garages and warehouses have a prototype in it that eventually the whole thing just collapsed, and it's sitting, I mean, literally, and the prototype's sitting in a barn someplace because you're going to need, $5 million to get going again, but the whole thing self-destructed because greed took over and these kinds of things. And so, again, to become a contender, to actually get, and again, Dennis, when he was doing the thing, he said, oh, it was just a heat pump. It wasn't even thinking free energy. But at that, how to say it, the attention that we received from just the local energy industry, okay, with a hitman who was a guy who was a provocateur who had fake alternative energy credentials and stuff, who infiltrated the company, and a woman died because of his actions and all these kinds of things. Again, we were maybe a nuisance. I mean, again, the global controllers, they took notice. They watched. They were like, oh, isn't that interesting? And again, as we're picking up the pieces a few months later, that's when we got the original friendly buyout offer. How about $10 million for your bright idea? And again, they added a couple zeros, a year later when we really started making some waves. But I would say that even when we were doing the thing in Ventura, I don't think anybody had ever become more of a threat. But at the same time, though, it wasn't much of a threat. I mean, really. And in the beginning, no. if you're thinking to get to that finish line, and we were, to get to the end zone, we were still at our own 30-yard line. I don't think anybody's ever passed the 50-yard line.
I remember years ago on the Open Minds radio show with Bill Jenkins. You know who that Bill Jenkins is? Years ago he had a radio show. And he used to have Bedini on all the time. And Bill Bedini.
Oh, Bedini, uh-huh.
John Bedini. Mm-hmm. He used to have him on the radio show all the time. And they were convinced that just down the road, just around the corner, that this was all going to be out in the open.
Oh, yes.
We're all going to have Bedini devices in our basements.
Yes.
And that it was inevitable. There's no way that they could stop this now.
It's unstoppable.
And that was like 20 years ago, right?
I've been there. Yes, I hear you. And, we got stopped. Yeah, we got stopped pretty dramatically.
Yeah. So I just thought it was amazing. I listened to a lot of the old radio shows, like the older radio shows, like Bill Jenkins, Open Minds, and uh-huh. he had Bedini on, he had Bearden on back then, a lot of the stuff there was going, and Bearden was telling stories about people being looked after, or people being manipulated and controlled in the industry.
Oh, yeah.
And they thought for sure that Bedini's stuff was going to be out in the public anytime now, that the time has come, that the people won't take it anymore, and
all that stuff.
And free energy is just, it's here, and there's nothing you can do about it. Well,
and you know what? My hat's off to that kind of optimism.
Oh, big time,
and at the same time, again, sitting back, and again, I can't talk publicly about a lot of the events and things I'm aware of, but again, I bet we weren't even to the 30-yard line, again, again, I don't think, in my opinion, in the current environment, particularly with so few people involved, that scaling the ramparts strategy has any kind of chance unless, and again, this is the thing, it's quite possible, I mean, and this may happen. And again, I don't want to say this can't happen. It's possible that a Greer or a Dennis or an O'Leary or a Byrne, somebody's going to, gird themselves, and they're going to finally try to storm that castle, and they're going to run up to it, and they're going to find the castle doors open, okay? And they're going to be going right through there, and there's the king on the throne there in the very back, and he's going to go, I'm glad you're here. What do you have? Oh, okay, let's do it.
Yeah.
That may happen. But if that happens, it's because that's how the king and his minions have decided. Okay, let's let this happen.
We'll let the rest of the people play with the toys now that we've had in our underground bases for the last 40 years.
Yes. Oh, this stuff's been around for a very long time. And in fact, again,
we get to use it, but no, you could not use this stuff.
Yeah. The stuff that I'm aware of, and again, this is stuff people very close to me have seen some of this stuff, okay? Today's physics textbooks, and this is one of my colorful sayings, look like cave drawings, okay, compared to the principles that this stuff operates under, okay? And my understanding is that the humans have this technology, et cetera, which is, again, I'd imagine a lot of us reverse engineered, captured ET craft, et cetera. But my understanding is that what we have is exceptionally primitive compared to the stuff, the thing that they copied, okay, is exceptionally primitive. And right. And again, it's a thing where, I've been following Gurr's work for a long time, and I've heard his witnesses talk about it. And again, the person that's close to me saw this stuff. I mean, they're describing the stuff that Gurr's witnesses are talking about. It's real. The stuff is real. But you and I aren't going to be invited to that show.
You don't get to play with those toys.
Yeah. In fact, when they showed it, it was just like, you see what we got here? Now we're going to put it back in the box, just letting you know it exists. You know.
Yeah.
And so that's
Wade, you recently started posting on a forum. Project uh-huh. Abalon has a forum. And yes. You have your own section in there now where you're posting and answering questions from people and giving them information on your history and what you're doing. And they can go in there and ask you questions. And that's a great thing. Uh-huh. Now, that's a recent thing. So in connection to that, I do have a question from one of the Project Abalon moderators,
yes.
Josh. Josh says, in the year 1901, around there, the people of Manhattan were polled and asked what the main problem would be in 100 years to the city of Manhattan. The most popular answer was there would be too much horse shit. From their perspective, they were working with what they knew at the time. They didn't know about cars and that they would come along and change the paradigm. So my question to you is would a new paradigm would be what visions of the future might we be failing to have due to the inability to conceive a new paradigm? How is our vision limiting where we wish to go, and how might technology change that vision?
Oh, that's a big question. And thanks for asking it. And again, I couldn't do that one justice in a day, but I guess I'll try to do the short answer here. And one of the things I say in my work is that I know that free energy technology exists. I know that, again, a host of exotic technologies exist, which could, I'm not saying they would, but they could change, they could usher in a new epoch of the human journey. And you know, all the major epics have always been defined by our energy practices. And if free energy technology was decentralized, everybody had it, this kind of thing, we could have something that looked a lot like heaven on earth. And what I've noticed in my journey was that kind of vision and what that would make possible is really difficult for people to imagine. You know, it's really a hard thing to understand. I mean, I've been living with this for many years, and I can barely imagine it. And so I'm sure that people who've never even heard of free energy, they don't know any idea what I'm talking about, you know. And so anyway, I think I hope I'm still answering your question. I think if we can't, my perception is if we can't imagine where we can go, then we're probably not going to get there, or at least, you know, we're not going to get there in a conscious way. We may stumble forward that way, but what I'm trying to do is get us to where we're more consciously imagining where we can go, so maybe we can go there. And that's interesting. Yes, so that's, you know, that's kind of the, you know, generals always fight the last war thing, that New York poll. That was funny. But, so I think that if we can't imagine, you know, that things, in fact, that's one of the things that's been, you know, frustrating for me. And in fact, when Brian and I did the Camelot interview a couple of years ago, he was talking about how lonely it is to be in this field because, I mean, it's lonely. I mean, very, very few people are thinking in those terms of not just, you know, free energy tinkers and stuff, but what it could mean. You know, what could the world civilization look like if you had free energy? And yeah.
They're you know, more thinking about their iPod and how cool it is.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a thing of, I mean, the world as we know it would end. I mean, that's the thing. It's like the implications are so, again, they're mind-boggling, totally mind-boggling. And it's something that is so immense. And it literally is the world. And again, the thing is that if you had heaven on earth, the world as we know it would no longer exist because heaven on earth doesn't look much like what I'm seeing out there. And so, but I think it can. And that's kind of, you know, that's the vision that's nourished me for a very long time. And I think that, you know, I think it's worth wrapping our minds around. And that's what I think. I think it's worth wrapping our minds, particularly when I know this stuff exists, you know. So It's like, I'm not asking people to imagine something that's like, you know, it's real. I'm saying it's like, what, I'm not doing a thought experiment so much. It's like, this stuff is real, but we don't get any right now. But if we did, what might that look like? Now, usually the first answer I will get when I say that, I mean, the reaction is we'd blow the planet up, or we would destroy the environment because we just strip mine the whole planet, except that's an energy scarcity way of looking at it, and that's kind of the scarcity-based paradigm implementation, I would say. And
or we'd just lay around. We'd all lay around and do nothing.
And do nothing. And I hear you. And
I'm not saying that's true. I'm just saying that's...
No, absolutely. And you know what? I wouldn't. I mean, there's a lot of... And that's where, you know, Bucky Fuller, when he talked about... in fact, Fuller back in the 80s, or in the, my God, in the 60s maybe or something, Fuller said if we didn't shift over from a scarcity-based paradigm to an abundance-based paradigm by, like, the 80s, which was, again, free energy was, I mean, that was like the keystone of it. He said the chances of humanity surviving were less than 50-50. And then he was saying that if we didn't solve this thing back in the 80s. Now, here we are, it's, you know, we're in the... What do they call? I don't know what they call this decade now, but anyway, here we are 30 years later and we're still around. And though it's like, I would say that, in fact, I think that human civilization has been in a emergency state for a very long time. And I mean, the bottom line is that hydrocarbon energy, I mean, we're burning it up, you know, somewhere between, you know, 10,000 and a million times as fast as it was, you know, created. And that's not sustainable, you know, and it's a thing where, and again, people like Fuller understood that. But however, though, if you go to an abundance-based paradigm, as Bucky Fuller said, you know, two men could still fall in love with the same woman. You know, you might have a problem there. But what Fuller thought was that humanities would no longer be concerned with survival, but self-realization. And if you think, it's kind of like going up Maslow's hierarchy of needs, I suppose, you know, but he's kind of going, we could go a few steps up that to where we are, you know, more into self-realization than survival. And my experience has been is that when I float out those ideas, how to say it, the gulf between what that could be in our daily lives, it's just, people can't handle it. And it sounds like Star Trek or something, you know, and it's so far outside of what they believe is the realm of the possible that it's just crazy. And what I'm trying to help people understand is that it's not crazy. You know, it's like this stuff can really happen. And In fact, I'm really hoping that in my lifetime, I see us, if we don't quite get there, at least I can see us moving in that direction. I mean, that's my hope. That's my dream.
It's funny. I did an experiment where I used to, I would ask people, well, what would you do if all of your needs were provided for and there was no money?
Yep.
No money existed. There was no exchange, nothing.
Yep.
And the number one answer I got in return was, I don't know. Now, some people said, I've always wanted to write, I would write. Some people said, well, I've always wanted to volunteer. I would just volunteer my time. No, but I'm telling you, the number one answer was, I don't know.
I'm going to try to say this in a most positive way, but what you just described is a big reason why we don't have it.
Yeah, the people are stuck in the paradigm to the point where the paradigm defines them.
Yep.
You know, so that would be their answer. I don't know. Okay, we got to wrap up this week's program. This has been Spectrum Radio Network on Station 2 talking to Wade Frazier, and we'll talk to you guys next week. Bye, Tom.
Goodbye. Bye-bye. Take care, Wade.
Thank you. It's been enjoyable.